travel somewhere new, a place to slow down, to breathe, and to gently let go of the day. There is nothing you need to do, nowhere you need to be. Just listen and allow yourself to drift. The morning begins quietly before the city is quite woken up. You are up early, earlier than you need to be, perhaps, and there is something soft and unhurried about the world at that hour. The streets of Munich are calm, the light still pale and low, the air already carrying the warmth of what promises to be a beautiful summer day. You stop along the way at a small bakery, the kind with a fogged window and a warm amber glow inside. The door opens and the smell reaches you before anything else. Butter, warm pastry, something sweet and faintly caramelized. You take a croissant, still warm from the oven, the layers of it flaking lightly as you hold it, the outside golden and ever so slightly crisp, the inside soft and yielding. You eat it slowly as you walk, each bite unhurried, the warmth of it spreading gently through you, and the morning feels easy and full of quiet promise. The coach is waiting, long and still and gleaming in the early light. You find your seat, settle in, feel the gentle give of it beneath you, and as the engine hums to life, as Munich slowly begins to slide past the windows, you feel yourself beginning to relax already before the journey has even properly begun. The city gives way, gradually, unhurriedly. Buildings become smaller. Streets become roads. Roads become stretches of open countryside. And then, in the distance, the first mountains appear, just shapes at first, soft and blue-grey on the horizon, like something painted lightly behind the world. But they grow slowly as the coach rolls south through Bavaria. The landscape opens around you, wide green meadows stretching away on either side, the grass impossibly rich in the summer sun, dotted here and there with wildflowers, yellow and white and pale violet. Forests come and go, dense and dark and cool looking, the pine trees tall and straight and still, and overhead, the sky is enormous and deeply blue, the kind of blue you only see on days like this, when the visibility is perfect, when the air is clean and the light is sharp and everything seems to have been rinsed and set out to dry. The Alps are closer now and you can see them properly, range after range of them, rising above the green foothills, their peaks pale against the sky, some still holding a faint memory of snow in the high hollows. There is nothing you need to think about, just this, the hum of the coach beneath you, the light through the glass, the mountains growing slowly, beautifully. Closer. The first stop of the day is Linderhof. The coach turns off the main road and you find yourself moving through a narrow valley, the road winding between forested hills, the trees crowding close on either side. and then the valley opens, and there it is, Lindehof Palace, small, exquisite, almost impossibly white in the summer sunshine. It sits in a hollow in the mountains, surrounded by formal gardens, and the forested slopes rise up all around it, so that the palace seems held, cradled in the landscape, like something precious placed carefully in the palm of a hand. You step off the coach, and the warmth of the day reaches you fully. The sun, high and generous, the air scented with grass and pine, and the faint sweetness of flowers. You stand for a moment, just looking, taking it in. Lindehof is the smallest of the three palaces built by King Ludwig II of Bavaria, the eccentric and reclusive king who dreamed in grandeur, and it is the only one he lived to see completed. Finished in 1878, it was his favourite home, the place he returned to most, living here for stretches of weeks and months, wandering these gardens in the small hours of the night, when the lanterns were lit and the world was quiet and entirely his own. You walk toward the palace slowly, following a path through the formal gardens. The gardens are laid out in the French style, inspired by the great gardens at Versailles, symmetrical and precise, but softened here by the mountain setting, by the wildness of the forests pressing in on every side. In front of the palace, a large pool catches the sunlight, and at its center, a fountain sends a jet of water 30 meters into the air, catching the light as it rises, breaking into a fine mist as it falls, and the sound of it is gentle and constant, a soft, continuous rushing. You pause by the pool for a moment, watching the water, feeling the faint coolness of the spray on your face. Behind the palace, a cascade falls down 30 marble steps, the water moving slowly and steadily, catching the sun as it descends. And at the bottom, a statue of Neptune stands in the foam, looking entirely at ease in his domain. You take your time, moving through the gardens, noticing how the flower beds have been planted in patterns, how the gravel paths are smooth and clean, how the topiary has been clipped with extraordinary precision, how every angle and axis has been considered, and yet how the whole thing breathes, how it lives in the summer warmth. Then you go inside. The interior of Lindehof is something quite different from anything you might have expected. The palace is small on the outside, but inside, every surface seems to have been given over to beauty, to a kind of concentrated, almost fevered opulence. You move through the rooms slowly, following the group, and each room reveals itself in turn. The ceilings are covered in frescoes, rich and detailed and glowing with colour. The walls are hung with tapestries, or panelled in gilded wood, or lined with mirrors in golden frames. There are only a handful of rooms with any real function. This was never meant to be a place of state or ceremony. It was a private sanctuary, a retreat, and you can feel that in the intimate scale of the rooms. sense of someone having made something entirely for themselves. In the bedchamber, the largest room in the palace, the bed stands behind a golden balustrade, raised like an altar, and overhead, a chandelier holding 108 candles catches the light. In the dining room, you learn that Ludwig ate alone always, never with guests, never with company. And in the floor of this room, hidden beneath a panel, is a mechanism, a table that could be lowered down through the floor to the kitchen below, set with food by the staff, who remained out of sight, and raised again, fully laid, so that Ludwig might eat without ever encountering another person. The mechanism still works today, the only one of its kind in the world. And then, at the end of the door, the hall of mirrors, you step in, and the room multiplies itself endlessly in every direction. Golden frames and candlelight, and your own reflection. Repeated and repeated, until the room seems to go on forever, and you feel very small. And very still, and quite suspended in all the reflected light. Back outside in the warmth, you take your time returning to the coach. You pass the Venus Grotto, an artificial cave dug into the hillside behind the palace, built by Ludwig as a private theatre, modelled on a scene from one of Wagner's operas. Inside, there is a small lake and a waterfall, and the cave was once lit by one of the first electrical installations in the whole of Bavaria. The lights changeable, shifting in color, blue and pink and gold, to suit the mood of whatever was being performed. Ludwig would be rowed across the water in a swan-shaped boat, while musicians played for an audience of one. You stand at the entrance of the grotto for a moment, feeling the cool air breathe out of it, looking at the shadows inside, imagining what it must have been like, the music, the coloured lights, the dark water. And then the coach is waiting, and you move on. Oberammergau is only a short distance away, and as you pull into the village, you understand immediately why people stop here. It is a small Bavarian village, set in a valley ringed by forested mountains. The peak of the Kofel rising above it, like a sentinel, and the buildings, almost every building you can see, is covered in paintings, not decorations, not patterns, but full paintings, scenes and figures and architectural illusions covering the facades of the houses from ground to roofline. You step off the coach and simply look. This art form is called Luftmalerei, and it has been a tradition in this part of Bavaria since the 18th century. The name itself is thought to come from a house called Zum Lüftel, where the most famous of these painters, Franz Seraph Zwink, once lived. Zwink painted many of the finest examples still visible in the village today, working in the open air, on fresh lime plaster, applying the colours quickly, before the plaster dried, because the technique allowed no corrections. Every brush stroke permanent. as it said, becoming part of the stone itself, which is why these paintings have survived for centuries, still vivid, still present, still quietly telling their stories to anyone who stops and looks. You walk slowly through the streets, and the paintings surround you. Saints and biblical scenes, figures from everyday life, hunters and farmers and angels, trompe-l'œil, columns and archways that seem to reach back into the walls, windows that are not windows, rooms that exist only in paint. The most celebrated building is the Pilatus House, painted in 1784, its facade showing the moment Pontius Pilate judged Christ before the crowd. The illusion so complete, so deeply rendered, that the flat wall seems to contain an actual space, an actual stage, with depth and shadow and weight. You move between the buildings, reading the walls slowly. And the village is quiet and warm, and smells of pine and cut grass. And the mountains stand all around, close and green and still. And everything feels unhurried and entirely itself. The coach climbs again, deeper into the Alps, heading southeast now, toward the mountains that have been visible on the horizon all day. And then, around a long curve in the road, Neuschwanstein appears, high on a ridge, almost impossibly high, its white towers rising out of the dark forest, pale against the blue sky, slender and fantastical, like something imagined, like something from the deep interior of a dream. You look at it through the window for a long moment, and something in you grows very quiet. The castle was built by King Ludwig II, begun in 1869, on the ruins of two medieval fortresses, high above the valley he had known since childhood. He designed it as a sanctuary, a private world, inspired by the operas of Richard Wagner, by medieval legend, by his own extraordinary and solitary inner life. He lived in it for just 172 days before his death, and it was never finished. Only 14 of the planned 200 rooms were ever completed. And yet, what remains is one of the most visited buildings on Earth. The castle that would later inspire Walt Disney, that would become the image that the entire world seems to carry when it thinks of what a castle should look like. The coach stops at the village of Hohenschwangau, at the base of the hill, and you begin to walk. The path winds upward through the trees, steep in places, the stones warm underfoot, the air thick with the scent of pine and warm grass, and something faintly mineral from the rock. You take your time, pausing now and then to catch your breath, to look back down through the trees at the valley below. The lake, the Alpsee, is visible through gaps in the forest, still and very blue, perfectly flat, reflecting the mountains above it in long, slow ribbons of colour. The higher you climb, the more of the valley opens below you, and the further away the world below begins to feel. The castle appears in glimpses through the trees, a white tower, a pointed turret, a stretch of pale stone wall. Never quite the whole of it, until you reach the Marienbrücke. The bridge spans the Polar Gorge, a narrow iron footbridge, suspended over the ravine, with the waterfall dropping away below, and beyond it, the full face of Neuschwanstein. Spread across the ridge, you step out onto the bridge, and you stop, because here, the castle is everything, rising from its rocky spur, tier upon tier, its white limestone catching the afternoon sun, its towers soaring, its balconies and arches and pointed rooftops layered against the blue sky, and the forest dark and rich on the slopes below it, and the valley spread wide behind you, the Alpsee glittering far below, the mountains folding back and back into the haze. You stand there for a long time, not speaking, not moving very much, just looking, feeling the warm air on your face, hearing the waterfall below, a constant soft rushing. The bridge very slightly alive beneath your feet. The whole vista impossibly still and impossibly vast at the same time. There are no words quite adequate for what it is to stand there, to look at that building in that light, at that hour of the day. You let it settle in, slowly, the way things only can, when you give them the time they deserve. The walk back down to the castle entrance, and then inside, into the cool stone interior, moving from the bright summer day into something quieter, and older, and stranger. The rooms of Neuschwanstein are unlike any you have seen. They are theatres, every one of them, built not to be lived in, but to be felt. In the throne room, you tilt your head back, and the ceiling rises above you like a sky. The vaulted space lit by a chandelier of extraordinary size, holding hundreds of candles. The walls lined with paintings of saints and kings and angels, all rendered in gold and deep jeweled color, a mosaic floor beneath your feet, and at the far end of the room, the space where a throne was always intended to stand, and never did. Ludwig died before it was ever built. In the singer's hall, you walk the length of a room designed for performances of Wagner's operas, the walls painted with scenes from The Legend of Parsifal, great swirling murals of forests and castles and knights and moonlit lakes, the ceiling arched and gilded, the acoustics of the room deep and resonant even in silence. Wagner himself never heard music played here. He died before the castle was finished. And this room, built in his honor, has waited for him ever since. In the bedroom, you stand before a carved oak bed of extraordinary intricacy, the woodwork so detailed, so patient. 14 carpenters, working for more than 4 years. To complete it, every surface carved with scenes from the medieval legend of Tristan and Isolde, the headboard a cathedral of tiny arches and pinnacles, the room lined with deep blue silk, a washbasin, a painting of a swan gliding on still water. Peaceful and entirely at home. In the grotto, you walk through a cave built into the interior of the castle itself. Artificial stalactites overhead. A small waterfall. The rock walls pressing close, and the light dim and cool and faintly blue. Another private world within a private world. Another layer of the dream Ludwig was always building, always extending, always retreating deeper into. You pass through the study, the dining room, the dressing room, each one held carefully, each one preserved exactly as it was, and the castle feels, despite everything, like someone's home, like someone who loved beauty so deeply it became its own kind of sorrow. And then, on the upper floor, there is a balcony, and you step out into the afternoon sun, and the world opens again below you. The lake, the Alpsee, lies below and to the north, and from this height, in this light, it is extraordinary. The water is a deep, clear blue, almost turquoise in the shallow places near the shore, and it glitters slowly in the long afternoon light, the surface catching and releasing the sun in long shifting patterns, like something breathing. The mountains stand all around it, their reflections moving gently in the water, and the forest descend to the shore in deep unbroken green, and the village of Hohenschwangau is visible, small and quiet and orderly, far below and beyond it. The valley stretches away, and the road you came in on is a thin, pale line, and all of it, all of this landscape, seems held in a kind of golden afternoon stillness that feels like it could last forever. You stand there for a while, with the warm stone of the balcony wall beneath your hands, and the light on your face, and the view so wide and so still that your thoughts begin to slow of their own accord, and your breath deepens, and the afternoon pours around you, golden and unhurried. Somewhere below, the village is going about its quiet late afternoon business. Swans move on the Alpsee in slow arcs, barely disturbing the surface. The air smells of pine and warm stone, and faintly of something sweet and cool drifting up from the valley. You begin the walk back down, taking your time. The light now shifting toward that particular quality it gets in the late afternoon in summer. Warmer. More golden. Longer shadows stretching across the path. The forest very still on either side. The sounds of the day growing softer. And you feel, in the way you sometimes do at the end of a day that has been full and long and beautiful, something settling in you, something easing, a quiet tiredness that is really a kind of contentment. The coach is waiting, just as it was this morning, and you find your seat, and the engine comes to life, and Neuschwanstein recedes behind you, its towers visible for a long time above the tree line, pale and dreamlike, growing small. journey back to Munich is long and slow and easy. The mountains pass in the windows, lit now in the amber of early evening. The shadows of the peaks stretching long across the valley floors. The sky above deepening toward a warmer blue. Someone hands you a cold beer, and you take it and hold the coolness of the glass in your hand and take a long, slow sip. The beer light and cold and exactly right, and you settle back and let the landscape move past you, not really watching it now, just aware of it, the green and gold and blue of it flowing quietly by. Your body is pleasantly tired, the good tiredness of a day well spent, the kind of tiredness that lives in your legs and your shoulders and behind your eyes, and you feel it with a kind of gentle satisfaction, knowing that you saw what you came to see, knowing that the day was full and beautiful and real. The coach hums, and the road unwinds, and the mountains begin to soften, their edges blurring slightly in the evening haze, and the fields return, wide and green and quiet, and Munich begins to appear again on the horizon, its rooftops familiar, its lights just beginning to show as the sky deepens, and everything is calm. And slow and gently fading. And now the day releases itself like a long, slow breath. The images of the day settle around you, gently, without urgency. The fountain at Linderhof catching the light, the golden rooms, the mirrors stretching on forever, the painted walls of Oberammergau, vivid in the summer sun, each figure standing quietly, telling its ancient story, the path through the forest, the stone warm underfoot, the castle glimpsed between the trees, the bridge, the gorge below, the waterfall, the castle spread across the ridge in the afternoon light, jaw-dropping and still, the lake below, glittering, breathing, impossibly blue. Let these images soften now and blur at the edges, the way things do at the end of a long, beautiful day, when sleep is coming. Quietly, certainly, like the mountains fading at dusk, like the water settling, like the light growing longer and slower and more golden, until it is almost nothing, just warmth, just stillness, just rest. You are here, and the day is done. And you have seen something beautiful. And now, there is nothing left to do, and nowhere else you need to go. Let your thoughts grow quieter now, one by one, like lamps going out in a window, in a village in the mountains, at the end of a summer evening. And the last light, very soft, very still, fading slowly. And now, as everything grows quieter and your thoughts begin to soften, you can stay here or drift somewhere deeper, knowing there is nothing left to do and nowhere else you need.